I'm Julie Burstein in on this gray Wednesday afternoon for Leonard Lopate. There are many stories in the press about Iran's leaders spouting anti-Semitic rhetoric, the proliferation of Iranian-sponsored terrorism, and the violent suppression within the country of views counter to the regime, not to mention Iran's nuclear aspirations. Flint and Hillary Leverett, Middle East experts who served on the U.S. National Security Council and the State Department, have a different view, that the Islamic Republic of Iran is a legitimate country more interested in protecting its own sovereignty than in wiping Israel off the face of the earth. In their new book, Going to Tehran, they trace the history of tension between the U.S. and Iran and make a case that the U.S. could increase its influence throughout the world if it reached out and established a new relationship with Iran now, the way it did with China in the early 70s. It's published by Metropolitan Books, and Flint and Hillary Leverett are here to talk about it. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Why do you believe that a more direct policy with Iran would be more useful than the one we've been using?
Well, I think for more than 30 years, since the Iranian Revolution, we have been trying to isolate, undermine, and ultimately get rid of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Even on its own terms, those policies have not worked. And combined with other policy mistakes we've made in the Middle East, failed wars and occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan, a war on terror that's actually, you know, made people more willing to support terrorist activity than the contrary, that in combination with these mistakes, these policies have put the U.S. position in the Middle East in free fall. We are a power in precipitous decline in the Middle East. And in that kind of environment, if we end up going to war to disarm yet another Middle Eastern country of weapons of mass destruction it doesn't have, in the current regional climate, that is going to be a disaster for the United States. And the only way we can really avoid that kind of catastrophe is by real rapprochement with the Islamic Republic of Iran, the kind of rapprochement that Nixon and Kissinger pursued with the People's Republic of China in the early 1970s.
We have no direct diplomatic relations with Iran, and there have been overtures over the past few years.
Yes.
Why do you believe there would be more receptivity on their end now?
I was authorized when I worked for the George W. Bush administration to deal with, to negotiate with Iranian officials over Afghanistan, Iraq, and Al-Qaeda, especially in the wake of 9/11 when I was assigned here to the U.S. mission to the United Nations here in New York. What was remarkable about that, I had been a Middle East expert for many years, had studied the Middle East, had traveled, lived in the Middle East, studied there. I had never met, let alone listen to, an Iranian official or anybody who supported the system of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I had met scores of Iran experts, all of them expatriates with a clear agenda. Maybe many of them left legitimately with legitimate grievances, but all of them had an agenda. Of course, I had met people in my own family who were pro-Israel, who also had a clear agenda in terms of looking at the Islamic Republic of Iran. I had never met people who supported it. And here I was, representing the U.S. government as an official in the wake of 9/11, talking about Afghanistan. These officials from the Islamic Republic were the most constructive, the most knowledgeable, and really the most helpful for us in terms of dealing with Afghanistan in the wake of 9/11. They had been completely against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda for years. The Taliban government in Afghanistan had killed several of their diplomats in their consulate in Mazar-e Sharif just a couple of years before 9/11. So it was something that really opened my mind to think about the Islamic Republic of Iran differently. And these diplomats said to me, when I would ask them, what about Israel, what about Lebanon, how you behave there? They said, think for just a moment about how we look at the world and how we acted and what our interests were in Afghanistan. And if you were in our shoes, what you would think of the United States coming into Lebanon, supporting Israel, a country that has vowed to attack us militarily, including militarily. What would your policy be? Would it be that different, you know, thinking about what we have? And I had to really think about that. One of the Iranian officials that I dealt with in particular said, you know, this isn't the first time we've dealt with and cooperatively, constructively dealt with American officials. And he walked me through, and this is something I was an expert on the Middle East, consider myself still to be one, that I hadn't really thought of in this way. He said, you know, in the 1980s, we worked with you, we, the Iranian government, worked with U.S. government officials to help you get your hostages out of Lebanon. it was known as the Iran-Contra affair. That episode of engagement failed not because we, the Iranians, pulled out, but because you, American officials, violated your own law to try to take proceeds of the money we gave you to give to Contras in Nicaragua. It wasn't because of us. And then he said, you know, a few years later, again, when the first George Bush, President George Bush, asked for our help to get the remaining hostages out of Lebanon and to be neutral when you went to try to kick Iraq out of Kuwait, we helped you. And, you know, there were official discussions. The UN, there was a UN envoy who was specifically charged with that. And the first President Bush even said in his State of the Union, goodwill would get goodwill. And we expected, we the Iranians expected, reciprocity. And we, you know, we gave you whatever we could. You decided in the wake of, you know, in the collapse of the Soviet Union, after you vanquished Iraq and the Gulf War, you didn't need to reciprocate. It wasn't that we pulled out of those talks. Again, he said, over Bosnia, we coordinated with you to get weapons to Muslims in Bosnia when your law prohibited it. And here we are yet again on Afghanistan, sitting with you at the table, taking your concerns, you, the United States, your concerns seriously, and working with you in whatever way we can.
But what's interesting is you were at that table, too. So wasn't the United States taking this seriously as well? I mean, I think these sort of back-channel conversations are so important, but it seems that your book has two major points. One is we should have conversations. Well, and the other major point, there seems to be a lot also in the book saying they're not so bad. And there's a tremendous amount of anti-American rhetoric that comes out of Tehran. And in your book, you encourage us to try to engage more deeply with them. What makes you think that the Ahmadinejad regime wants to talk with us when this rhetoric comes out?
Can I just come back for 1 minute? Yes, they have come to the table, and we have come to the table each time. But each time, it was actually because we asked them. We wanted something from them. And they cooperated. They gave us not everything, but most of what we asked for, and we pocketed it. Each time after each of these episodes, whether it was Iran-Contra, weapons to Muslims in Bosnia, Afghanistan, each time the situation on the Iranian side was much worse for them. We actually got much closer to the brink of conflict because in the United States, when each of these episodes became known, we were so embarrassed to be dealing with this caricature of a terrorist-supporting anti-Israel entity that we couldn't continue and we had to punish them. So our book actually does not call for more talking just to talk. It calls for accepting the Islamic Republic like Nixon and Kissinger did with People's Republic of China. Nixon and Kissinger had 136 discussions. The United States had 136 discussions with China before they decided they could accept the People's Republic of China. And what they realized, and what we have realized too from our own experience and from our research, is that if you keep talking and you don't change the position, talking can actually entrench hostile positions and get you nowhere and even closer to the brink of military conflict.
What does acceptance mean then? What is it that you're talking about in terms of accepting the Islamic Republic?
I think that it's important for Americans to understand that this is not a system which is implacably hostile toward the United States. They have made plain over years, from the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei on down, that they want better relations with the United States, but that those relations have to take place on the basis of mutual respect, on the basis of equality, and getting to this point of U.S. acceptance of the Islamic Republic. What acceptance means, and this is the great, what Nixon and Kissinger did with the People's Republic of China that enabled the opening to China in the early 1970s. What acceptance means is accepting the Islamic Republic as a legitimate political order that represents legitimate national interests and dealing with it on that basis. That's fundamentally what acceptance means. And even though we have, as Hillary laid out, periodically talked to Iran and accepted Iranian cooperation on issues that mattered to us at various points, we have never, not even under President Obama, been prepared to accept the Islamic Republic in this way. And until we do, we are not going to be able to realign relations with this important country. And ultimately, that's bad for the United States.
The current regime in Iran is extremely oppressive. Women and minorities of all kinds face harsh treatment there. And we saw horrifying violence deployed against the most peaceful protesters during the Green Revolution in 2009. By engaging with Iran, isn't there a risk that we legitimize this kind of behavior?
I think, first of all, that you know, you could make that argument that when Nixon and Kissinger went to China, the Cultural Revolution was still going on. Mao Zedong was still in power. And at the time that Nixon visited, the Chinese government had killed probably about 3 million of its own citizens in the course of the Cultural Revolution. We believe that Nixon did the right thing by going. And I think you'd be hard put to make an argument that the United States or the Chinese people or the world would be better off if he hadn't gone. I think that there are a lot of myths, a lot of distortions about all of these issues that you've raised in Iran. You mentioned the status of women. The fact is, compared to virtually any other American ally in the Middle East, the status of women in Iran is better than in, you know, almost any other country in the region. The Islamic Republic, since the revolution,
they have some very low competition. Well, I have to say.
But the majority of university students are women. The majority of medical students.
But they're not allowed to study what they want.
That has been grossly misreported in the United States. The majority of medical students in Iran, for example, are female.
You know, a lot of my experience with Iran is through people like Azar Nafisi. As you say, these are people who have left.
Right.
But the stories that they tell about what is happening there are horrifying.
The biggest advances for women in Iran, in Iran's history, and this is just borne out by the data, have happened under the Islamic Republic. There are pictures and images of this tiny elite, Western-oriented, secular elite, under the Shah's regime, who thrived, who went to university without veil. But the story that we miss that is so important is that was a tiny minority. The vast majority of women under the Shah were illiterate and had to stay home, like in Afghanistan. What the revolution did in Iran, what the Islamic Revolution did, it opened education for women. It means today, instead of the vast majority, 32% of women were illiterate under the Shah. Today, it's nearly universal education. The World Bank says that Iran is coming very close to reaching gender equality in educational access. What we've seen in terms of their human development rate, it's actually gone up. When we're in Iran, there are women taxi drivers, there are women bus drivers. It's not only that they're the best, they're the majority of students at universities, period. They're the majority of students at the best university in some of the hardest faculties to get into. They are not only expanding access to education, which is dramatically altering the status of women in Iran today, but they're doing so in a way that enables women to work. So they actually have incredibly, by our standards, for example,
are you saying that there's no repression? I mean, I understand.
No,
I
there's
see
repression
that
everywhere. I mean, here, look, I'm a working mom. I didn't have maternity leave.
We're not talking about maternity leave there, though. We're talking about being able to assert yourself as an individual. We're talking about being able to study what we want. So I think
when we
make these apples to oranges comparisons, it becomes very muddy.
But you're asking people to make apples to oranges comparisons for people in their own culture that have not just 1,000+ years of Islamic culture, but 5,000 years of a tribal culture, of a civilization where things have worked for them in terms of how they protect themselves and their security. The alternative is not Finland, is not Holland. The alternative is Afghanistan. And what Iran has done to alter the status of women in their education, in their health care, their life expectancy is dramatic and vastly underappreciated here. And what we're trying to do by pummeling them, by sanctioning them, threatening them, is we're making it even harder for not just women, but for all Iranians to thrive. It is an Islamic republic because this is a republic that allows political participation, tremendous education access, real health care for people within an Islamic framework. Now, we may not be Muslims. We may not agree with that for ourselves. But the vast majority of people there are Muslims.
But and there for the are first people time, there who don't agree with it either, who are repressed and punished for that.
Yeah, but this is – so we were with two colleagues, and I thought this was very, very interesting. If we want to push our view, we will have to push it and fight it and impose it. We had two colleagues, one who had stayed in Iran and fought, for example, through the Iran-Iraq War, and one who had left because of the various reasons that you put forward. And, hey, come here and got a green card and is now a happy Iranian-American. And they were arguing about what happens in Iran. He said, you know, the difference, the person who stayed and fought, he said, you know, the difference between you and me is that I stayed and fought. You were just happy to get a green card. There's nothing wrong with that. But that means you now want to impose your views on the people that stayed and fought.
Well,
so
is it really democratic
if you're trying to force people to adopt a different way?
But what I'm saying is there still are people there who wish that they had the freedoms that their fellow citizens who have left and come to this country now enjoy. And that in that country, and there are, as I said, there are two issues in your book. One is, should we have conversation? And the other is, well, maybe it's not as bad as we think. And do we have to have both of those? Can't we have conversations and also look very clearly at what's going
on
there?
You can't ask the Islamic Republic of Iran to negotiate its internal political future with the United States any more than you could ask the People's Republic of China to do that and realign relations with it. You know, it's the Iranian people who are going to determine their own future.
I understand that. And I'm not saying that we should determine their future, but I also don't think we should ignore the things that are going on there in order to have a conversation.
Well, then you're not going to have a very constructive conversation.
Well, you just said you had conversations with them during the Afghanistan war. So we do have conversations. I don't understand why we can't continue with those.
Because those lead more and more towards war. More and more towards military conflict. The problem, what we argue, is just having conversations. Our book is not about just having conversations. Our book actually specifically argues that having conversations further entrenches the hostilities and leads us closer to war, which is why people are shocked to hear this, but they know it for a fact, that we are closer today than when President Obama came in pledging to engage. Because you can't just have conversation while you're sanctioning, threatening, and undermining and pursuing all these covert operations. That can't happen.
So we just have a minute left. What would the U.S. gain, from your point of view, in creating a new relationship with Iran?
We would gain not only a constructive relationship with the Islamic Republic of Iran and peace and stability in the region more broadly, but we could rescue our position in the Middle East, similar to how Nixon and Kissinger rescued our position in Asia after two enormously destructive wars in Vietnam and Korea. We need it today, not just vis-a-vis the Islamic Republic of Iran, but how are we going to deal with Egypt, with Saudi Arabia, when there's change there? This is what's happening in the Middle East. The United States is a power on the decline. The Islamic Republic of Iran is the one that is winning essentially a soft war strategy, and we need to deal with them to save our own position.
People in this region don't want Western-style secular liberalism. They want participatory politics combined with Islamic principles and institutions. That is the future of governance in this region. And in order to come to terms with that, we're going to have to come to terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Otherwise, we're going to lose in this part of the world.
I've been speaking with Flint and Hillary Leverett. Their latest book is called Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. It's published by Metropolitan Books. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.